morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and elsewhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today and every Thursday morning from 11 to noon from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, how's this for a job title? Director of the Office of Life, Justice, and Peace. Definitely not your average everyday job, but it is filled here in the Diocese of Orange by someone who is most definitely suited for the role, and that is Greg Wagenbach, who is here with us in the studio today. Greg, many thanks for taking time to be with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Rather than me giving our listeners the yearbook definition of what your office does, why don't you give us a brief overview of what goes on there day to day?
Great. And by the way, my wife and my kids both give me a hard time for that title, too. So we get calls, emails from folks throughout the Diocese of Orange, throughout Orange County, asking us about any number of topics. So if I just walk you through a day-to-day time period, some of it's spent fielding questions we have. Somebody saw something on the news or something's happening in a community, and what does the church have to say about this, or how are we responding to that? So a lot of it is very topical in that sense. We also get folks who call in who have very practical need for services. So a referral for a shelter for a pregnant young woman, somebody who's looking for a local food pantry, or a good immigration attorney, right? So then we'll kind of help field those calls and make sure people are getting to the right place to hopefully have their needs met in a timely way, and also in a Christian way, a Catholic way, to be able to share the love of God with them over the phone. I love that part of the job, because although I'm not always the one providing the direct service, a lot of times in times of crisis, people are hoping for somebody who's a good listener, somebody who's able to show compassion in the transition. It's not like going into an office and taking a ticket but really showing the love of Christ as we go along. In addition to that, we go out to parishes, we give talks, we meet with our Respect Life and Justice and Peace reps that are at each of our parishes, many of our parishes throughout the diocese, and we'll do formation opportunities. We'll do other things like that. Just a quick story that illustrates what we do in our office. One day we got a call from a Respect Life rep at one of our parishes. She helps lead the effort at that parish to raise thousands of dollars for our Pennies from Heaven campaign.
Oh, yeah.
That funds the pregnancy clinics and shelters and centers. And she came in because she needed a letter of good standing for the immigration department. She is in deportation proceedings and hoping not to be separated from her kids and her husband and her community and all the great work she's doing, life as she knows it, really. And so she was in her office. I'm hoping to get a letter to see what we could do to help with that. And thanks be to God, we were able to address her situation, get her a letter, and she was given an extension, and her family is working through that whole process. But here's a woman serving at her parish, doing great work in life and justice and all the rest. And so it's a privilege to be able to work with people.
Well, some of the issues that are on the plate of your office are perennial. They're ongoing. They're going to be there all the time. Some crop up with changes in society, politics, other factors. For example, your office is doing a lot of work right now to try to defeat State Senate Bill 128, which is the physician-assisted suicide bill, right?
That's right. Bishop Vann came out very early as a leader on this issue, and we've been working with the Californians Against Assisted Suicide Coalition that's comprised of disabilities rights groups, patients' rights groups, elder abuse groups, people of faith, as well as other secular groups that are concerned for the most vulnerable among us, and concerned really for what our response is as a state to those who are vulnerable and in those times of need. We just held a large conference with an array of speakers, Dignity and Courage at the End of Life, not just a religious conference. It was a conference with doctors and palliative care specialists and nurses, and testimonies from people who are struggling with terminal illness, who are facing some of those very real.
Just over last week, and you know.
That's right.
Very interesting as well.
And so part of what we do, and the purpose of holding these events, is to really energize people and form people and help them understand, again, not just a religious perspective, although we do have that, but really just to learn more about medical decisions at the end of life, about what options there are for people that are really legitimate medical options. You know, learn more about palliative care, learn about hospice care, learn about the excellent pain management that is available. And so we're trying to help people bring that message to others and to get engaged at their parishes, really in two main ways, in what Bishop Vann has called the prophetic side, which is really speaking truth to our society, to our legislators, calling on them to oppose this legislation and to be informed about that, but also the pastoral side. You know, what are we doing to walk alongside people as they face these situations? How are we teaching people about the many ways that they can be served, and really just having that presence, the presence of Christ alongside somebody when they're in need?
Well, one of the issues that would very much be in the pastoral milieu, I guess, would be the immigrants and immigration reform. This is one of your continuing focuses in your advocacy. Tell us a little bit about some of the progress there. What's been going on lately with that?
The latest news is that the DACA and DAPA, what are known as the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals and another program for parents of citizens that were part of an executive action, those programs, which will provide relief to millions of aspiring Americans, have been put on hold in the courts. And so in one sense, we're in a little bit of a holding pattern. But I'm very proud to say that the church in Orange County has really become a leader on this issue, working closely in a multi-diocese strategy with the Archdiocese of L.A. and San Bernardino. And we have held and we have been involved in some of the largest immigration events in the whole nation in the last couple of years. 2,000 people in Brea in procession, in prayer and advocacy with our Representative Royce and constituents from all 16 parishes in his district there to pray and to be present and to share stories. And we took 25 leaders in from those parishes to meet with him. 3,000 people later in one of the first events at the cathedral held here to call for advocacy and prayer on immigration reform with Bishop Van and Bishop Salazar of LA and many others. And last summer, we took 30 buses to the regional mass for immigrants up in LA from Orange County, 30.
Right.
And we really packed the house up there. And it was great to see the energy and excitement. Really, it's about solidarity. It's about how do we call upon the broader community to recognize the gifts that these sisters and brothers in our midst have, and that our communities are really only as strong and as stable and as safe as our most vulnerable members and our most vulnerable families, and how do we do everything we can to come together around them. And just a couple things we've been doing on that is we've been holding forums for the driver's license law that just passed at the beginning
right.
of this year.
Right.
Even though things are held up at the federal level, the state of California has done a few things to really address some of these needs in our immigrant communities, and that's one of them. So we've been holding forums to help our immigrant sisters and brothers know what these laws entails and see if they want to apply for those licenses, and to help them in the test taking for that, and to be prepared for all those. Also warning against immigration fraud as we await these programs to come into place, as we await, God willing, comprehensive reform that really opens this up, that people aren't being taken in by folks who are trying to take advantage of them. Finally, Catholic Charities of Orange County we've been working with parishes and Catholic Charities to open up a hub in every deanery, every geographic region in our diocese, so that volunteers from those parishes can help applicants for these programs, DACA and DACA, to apply and to help Catholic Charities expand their capacity to process the. We have 160,000 people in Orange County that potentially qualify for those programs, and Charities also is opening up a new office in South County at San Felipe de Jesus and St. Edward's. So that's very exciting as well to see.
Well, one of the opportunities coming up for people to get directly involved in advocacy, not necessarily directly through your office, but on their own, people are going to be coming from everywhere for this, is Catholic Advocacy Day in Sacramento. It's coming up on April 28th. Tell us a little bit about what that's all about and how people might get involved.
Well, we're taking, I think right now we're at 16 people who are going up to Sacramento on that day, on the 28th, to meet with our legislators. So we try to get a good cross-section of folks from throughout our county so that we can bring constituents into each legislator and to come before them and to share our passion around particular issues that as a whole state, the California Catholic Conference is coming in from all the dioceses where folks are coming in to talk about these issues. So usually there's about four or five different areas. We have a bill on related to restorative justice, related to respect life, a bill related to education policy around tax credits, something our bishops have been working on to help parents as well as new teachers and families. And of course, at the top of our list this year is really making sure we meet face to face with our legislators about the assisted suicide bill and
sure.
ask them to oppose that, and really to help inform them about what our doctors and nurses and folks in our communities are saying about that. that?
Well, the first word in the title of your office is life, and your office consistently addresses life issues. It is a very broad and inclusive subject, but is it difficult to get your arms around everything you want to get it around? Is it something that is constantly before you and you sort of have to pick and choose?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a list on our website of issues from A to almost Z, from dealing with issues around abortion all the way down to torture and war. And so really, the life issue is really central for us. And the U.S. bishops, in their seven themes of Catholic social teaching, their summary of social teaching of the church, the very first one is the life and dignity of the human person. And so that really drives our work around all of these issues. And whether it's the direct threats to life of abortion and assisted suicide or euthanasia, but also the other issues people sometimes forget, like the affront to life and dignity and the use of the death penalty, or the targeting of civilians in war that often comes under the euphemism of collateral damage.
Sure.
Domestic violence is a huge problem in our community. So we kind of look to address all these issues. I will say on that last one, last year in California, the state increased funding for abortion providers by 40%, even as it continued a 10% cut for other fees around essential services through Medi-Cal. So we're really trying to say, as a state, can't we take on better policies that will help women and children and families to thrive as a whole and not lose sight of the big picture, so that becoming an abortion would become unthinkable for people, or policies to strengthen families with economic stability, wages, et cetera, so that more people will consider getting married, having kids, and forging these greater solidarities rather than seeing public policy as sort of a zero-sum game. That's a huge part of the role of our office, and really at the core of it is the gospel, and Pope Francis has been so good about bringing us back to the basics of it's really about how are we loving our neighbor and how are we loving God in the process.
Well, Greg Walgenbach, thanks again for coming down to the studio today to be with us and to share with our listeners what the Office of Life, Justice, and Peace in the Diocese of Orange is all about. Please come and visit us again.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear from the man who keeps one of the most ambitious high school choral music programs around in great shape at Modern Day High School. Stay with us. Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio, AM 1000, and we're joined in the studio by Scott Melvin. He is the director of choral music at Modern Day High School. Now, if you're a music educator out there, this is the guy you either envy or pity, because he is at the head of one comprehensive choral music program that includes five choirs and a handbell ensemble, plus there's a barbershop club, that's a barbershop quartet singing. There's a junior high honor choir in the mix, and a madrigal feast, and individual vocal study, and an AP music theory class. And now I have to take a breath.
Now, I have to take a breath, too. I didn't realize we did all that.
Well, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Absolutely.
Well, by any yardstick, this is an ambitious high school program. Did it take an effort to build, or has it been a part of the modern day landscape for a long time?
Well, it really truly has been part of the modern day landscape. It's an incredible program that, you know, has gone through, of course, its ebbs and flows. But I would say that, you know, over the last decade, we really have taken the school and the program with the performing arts, all of it, to a different level, which has been really fun to watch. And the support from the school and the administration has always been present. You know, I look at a number of my colleagues that have to face so many struggles within the public school system as far as funding and advocacy. And luckily, because of the Catholicity of our school and the understanding of the grounds of what choral music and just all religious music that we're supporting here has to do with the church and the growth of our students, we've really been able to do what we want to do religiously, performance-wise, and really educating these kids to be really mindful artists.
Well, I'm about to speak a term that all music educators absolutely hate. Back in the late 1970s, and here it comes, Proposition 13.
Ooh, yuck.
Yeah. It just eviscerated music and arts programs in many, right, many public schools. Did modern day hold on to its musical traditions in the face of all that, or was it affected to a degree as well?
I think the only way that it was affected was in as much as the students that were coming in weren't as prepared as they used to be.
Right.
To be quite honest, we took a different approach at that point in what we had to educate these kids in. It's always, I hate to use the word laughable, to look at the state standards and what we're expected to have students learning up until their eighth grade year.
Mm-hmm.
If we had that, I'd have college musicians in as freshmen. And unfortunately, like you said, with Proposition 13 and another other type of really destructive policies, the arts were really pushed aside. Now, we're lucky in the parochial schools not to have as much of that because we weren't state-funded to begin with. So luckily, we still had the tradition of kids cantering in masses, still providing music for their parishes. And so that didn't go too far away. And I would say through that time is when our band program really grew. I mean, they were marching the Rose Parade. We had 150 strong in there.
Right.
And so we didn't feel the effects of it as much. The ebbs and flows of our program really don't go with the ebbs and flows of the programs in the public system, I would say.
Very lucky in that sense.
Oh, amen. Absolutely. And I would like to say, too, that as much as I loathe the show Glee, it helped our programs because it showed kids, you know, regardless of what background you come from, you can participate. And that's what's so great about here at Modern Day. I've got ASB presidents in here. I've got varsity football players in here. I've got water polo kids. Coming up in our senior musical this weekend, we're putting on Footloose, opening Thursday night and going all the way through Sunday. We have one of our leads was a standout water polo player. He's now a fantastic player on our volleyball team. Our ASB president has never stepped on stage, never sung, and he's got a lead, and he is just absolutely tearing it up on stage where he never thought he could step up and do something like that. And it's those moments that really make you as a teacher go, oh, this is why we do it. And it's really, really fun.
Well, you anticipated my next question here, and I'm very happy to hear the way it's gone. I was going to ask that occasionally choir can be a tough sell. Now, you know, how do you persuade kids whose voices are developing and maybe changing and who might be self-conscious? How do you persuade them to get up and join a choir? Singing for a lot of people is a traumatic thing.
Lots of candy and commission-based performance. No, we don't. None of that. But there are times when you're building a program, you need to acknowledge when you need to provide a function of fun and convenience, and when you bring in the artistry. There was a study that I heard at one of the conventions I went with a boys chorus from Chicago that said, what are the main things that you look to marketing for your programs? And the boys chorus, of course, said travel opportunities, musicality,
yeah,
growing that way. And when they did the study of the parents, it was, is it convenient? Is it cost-effective? And is my kid going to have fun?
Yeah.
And once you get into the point where the kids are having fun, once you get them in the seats, that's when you give them Handel. That's when you give them Verdi. And that's when they go, oh my gosh, this is amazing literature. I understand why it's been around for 200 years now. And then the light clicks, and then it's there for the rest of their lives.
Well, you just mentioned your lead in Footloose. What change in general do you see in students when they discover that they can actually sing, and they can actually blend with other voices, and they can actually maybe sing Verdi or Brahms or some of the great classics? Does the light really go on? I mean, can you just sit there and watch that bulb go click?
Oh, absolutely. And it's different for every kid. I remember my click was singing with Chapman University. We went to Italy and we sang in the Sistine Chapel. We were singing Sicut Servus, written by Palestrina, written for the chapel.
Oh my.
And the first note went and I just wept. I just stopped. I couldn't sing. So my biggest musical moment, I wasn't even singing in. And at that point I said, I need to do this for other kids. And so I moved on to that, and I've had kids in the same position. We've gone to Italy twice now with the choir, actually three times with the choirs, Rome twice. We're going to Rome again next spring during the Easter season, and we're going to have that same opportunity where we walk into the Sistine Chapel, and there is nobody in there. We go in after hours, and then we get to join in song as a Catholic community there together. And at that point, kids just go, you know, this is bigger than me. This is, and it's not just about music. Actually, it's very, very little to do about music and more about the community of belonging and faith that really transcends. And that's hard to teach kids. It's an experiential type of moment that has to happen. You can't give them a book. You can't do it. They just need to have it happen. And I can't begin to tell you, not only the students, but the parents that come up and go, I had no idea. I just had no idea. And it is, and a lot of times those moments don't even happen in the Sistine Chapel. They happen in our rehearsal room. And we'll have a moment that is just exactly how it's supposed to sound. That is what's in our head. That's what in our hearts. It happened, and everyone goes, whoa.
And they have been striving toward that for many rehearsals, and all of a sudden it coalesces, and there's that great moment of emotion there.
Yeah, and I wish it happened in performance more than it happened in the rehearsal room, but there is something really beautiful and intimate about that happening for just the ensemble, because then the kids acknowledge that it's not about the audience as much as it is. Granted, you need to make sure that you're programming and preparing for an audience, but it's about that inner discipline that you're creating, that when they move forward, it's not about the sticker that they get on their paper. It's not about the grades that they get on the report card, because your bosses sometimes don't care. And the affirmation needs to come from within, as opposed to some outside force propelling you through. I mean, you can sit around and do that all your life, but you're going to regret a lot. Where I think my goal with these kids is to make them realize that regardless if it's music that is their passion, if it's accounting, if it's architecture, they can still have a moment of strength, knowing that it's them that's creating it, and it's not for anything other than themselves pushing themselves.
Well, that does bring me to this. Do you have many of your students who go on to major in music in college, or if they don't, who go on to sing in their church choirs or in community choirs or a choir, say, like the Pacific Chorale here in Orange County? Do they continue on with their choral music into adulthood?
Absolutely. That's one of the great things that I get to see. I make it a point not to friend any of my students on Facebook or Instagram until after they graduate. And then after they graduate, I get to see all of their accomplishments and all of their musical voyage as they go forward. And it's awesome. I've got kids in Performance Riverside. I've got kids over at the Pacific Chorale. I've got kids and teachers up at the Ellie Master Chorale, and they're moving around auditioning and doing stuff. Also, there's just a multitude of modern day graduates out there that are cantering and participating, and it's really heartwarming to see that happen. But I think more importantly is I get to see the kids that I know that are not going to study music. I know they came to modern day because the academic rigor of this school preps them for college like no other school around, and they're going to be a business major. They're going to be a law major. But they're singing with groups like the Westminster Chorus, which is run by our assistant director here at Modern Day, Justin Miller, which is a fantastic barbershop group. And they're singing with Masters of Harmony, and they're singing with all these other community groups because music is just such a part of them still. And that's really invigorating, because those are the people that are going to consume the music well as well. They're going to be attending the concerts. They're going to be going, and they're going to keep the arts going and rolling. If we don't have that, the arts dissipate, and then it's the art for the artist's sake, and we don't get to propagate from there, and that's when it starts to die out.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk. I definitely want to have you back on the show again to discuss this more. But Scott Melvin is the director of choral music for Modern Day High School. If you would like to see many of his students in action, the senior musical is going to be presented this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The musical is Footloose, correct?
Absolutely. We actually have a Thursday show as well.
Oh, okay.
And then I wanted to plug one more thing, just because I know the Orange County Catholic listeners will really appreciate this. We are joining with a couple of colleges, University of Redlands, Fullerton College, in a presentation of Verdi's Requiem at Christ Cathedral on May 8th at 8 o'clock.
Yes.
And tickets are available on the Christ Cathedral website. It's going to be amazing. And so hopefully we can get a lot of people out there. And it's, again, to get these kids singing the Verdi Requiem in high school is just crazy. And we're so blessed to have such great support from around the entire Catholic community and from the school here to do that.
Come out and see it. Scott, thanks so much again for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. We really appreciate talking with you.
Next up, are you smart enough to compete in an academic decathlon at the junior high level? Stay with us and find out when we come back. We're back, and on the phone with us is Lori Stanley. Lori is a former academic decathlon coach for Blessed Sacrament School in Westminster. Lori, the Blessed Sacrament team recently had a pretty terrific showing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we were first place in the Diocese of Orange with an unprecedented perfect score in our super quiz. So we answered all of the questions correctly, and it had not been done before. The super quiz has about 50 multiple choice questions. They ranged from questions about religion, English, literature, science, mathematics, current events, social studies, fine arts, and the religion being of the Roman Catholic doctrine. So we were so impressed with our students having achieved that for the first time in the Diocese of Orange.
That's fantastic. Now, this is at the junior high school level, right?
Correct, correct. So there were 7th and 8th grade students who participated from our school.
Okay.
In that event.
Well, a lot of us have heard about academic decathlons, but I will bet that only a very few people know exactly how they work. In general, what goes on in competition and how do students prepare for it?
So basically, there's 10 events, and of the 10, there's 2 team events. And the 2 team events are worth about 8,000 points each. The 2 team events are a logic quiz and then a super quiz. So you have the remaining 8 events test the individual team members' knowledge in English, literature, science, math, current events, social studies, fine arts, and then the Roman Catholic doctrine. And each of those individual events is worth 1,000 points.
Now, when we're talking about individual events, we're talking about individual students being quizzed. They don't get to put their heads together with anybody else.
Correct. That's correct. So it's individual, and then the 2 team events are more collaborative. Where all 10 are working together to get the right answer.
Now, what is the super quiz? Does that include questions from all different kinds of categories?
Yes. It deals with 50 multiple choice questions on a broad spectrum. So, for instance, the literature had a specific genre that they were dealing with, and so they had to study these questions. They didn't know which questions were going to be asked. Literature, religion, and then science, fine arts, and history. So all of these questions were asked of each of these topics. So 10 questions per topic were asked.
Well, do you find that you have to encourage students to come out for the team, or are some students just eager to do something like this? I would imagine if you approach some kids, they'd say, oh, my gosh, it sounds, you know, too much like work. It's just more schoolwork. Why would I want to do it? But I imagine there are some kids that that really get a kick out of it.
Yes, I think automatically one assumes that, oh, no, I have to have straight A's in order to participate in this type of event. But once it's explained to the students, they realize, you know what, maybe we can do it together. And I think once we push the collaborative aspect of the competition, those students that are initially shying away from the event and the practice and the study start feeling like, you know what, maybe we can take a shot at this because we're doing it together. And those that are participating in the individual events know that they're going to have study buddies. And so the study buddy is going to help them with their individual event by just quizzing them and encouraging them and meeting with them every day during the week.
Now, a study buddy is another student, is that right?
Correct, another student.
Okay. And are some kids good at one or two or three particular subjects and not all that great at another, and they find that the collaborative nature of some of this kind of picks up the slack?
Yes, I would say that is the case oftentimes. I mean, there are incidents where you do have a student who says, I am really good at math, but they may say that because they test very well. But in math, they also need to know that they're studying a specific given arena, and that is what they have to study, and they have to feel comfortable with that. So it just really depends. You do find that there are a number of students who excel in one or two areas, and they would make a collaborative team very, very strong.
Well, how about the kids who don't necessarily consider themselves to be top students, but who would like to participate anyway? Is there a place for them on the team as well, and do they find that they enjoy it?
I would say yes. We have had incidents whereby we have students that have competitive natures, and they are capable, they have good work habits, And just with a little bit of coaching, they are able to focus on the task at hand and come together with that good dose of team spirit that can really be an asset to the team. So yes, we have seen instances where students have not been exceptionally strong, but collaboratively and with a lot of support from the parents and the staff and the coaches, we've seen a lot of success in that area.
Well, describe the role of the coach. You've been a coach. Describe what a coach does. What do you bring to the game here? Are you more like a tutor or a teacher or what?
I would say that in my experience, I started off as being the rah-rah person and somewhat of a tutor. And then, of course, there's a little psychology that comes along with it. And you are an encourager. You become that support system for that child and just boosting their confidence. And then also knowing when to push a little harder and push that student to their, probably to a degree that they've not experienced before. And then also know when to let up and say, okay, let's just, you know, take a little break here.
Right.
Revisit. So you just have to know how to be a good encourager. Know how to pull the strengths from each child that you tutor or that you coach out so that they can really put their best foot forward.
Well, let's have a little bit of fun here. I've asked you to prepare a handful of questions that might appear on a junior high school academic decathlon. Let's hear a couple here.
Okay. So here's a religion question.
All right.
And based on St. Francis, what verses from the Bible were selected during the Sortes Biblicae?
Oh.
And Sortes Biblicae is a popular method of divining the will of God on specific matters. The random selection of three verses from the Bible, method used by St. Francis. Okay, so that's what that is. So I'll read the question again. What verses from the Bible were selected during the Sortes Biblicae? A, Mark 10, verse 21. Luke 9, verse 3, and Luke 9, verse 23, or B, Mark 1, verse 9, John 9, verse 3, and Matthew 10, verse 21.
Now,
or C, Mark. So it's A, B, C, D, and E, and this is all asked to the students, so they have to know the answer quickly.
Okay, this is stuff that they would be studying normally in the classroom, right?
Correct.
Okay, I imagine. Well, I'm stumped.
How about another one?
Yeah, how about another one?
Okay, a little easier perhaps. Here's a science one. Ocean fertilization has been proposed as a solution for A, producing biomass for the production of biofuels, B, reducing eutrophication in ocean basins, C, increasing nitrification of coastline soil, D, reducing carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, or E, all of the above.
Wow. Well, okay. Anytime I see an all of the above, I'm going to go for it. Is that the answer?
It is not the answer.
I knew it.
So D, the answer, reducing carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, do you have a third one?
I'll try to make it very short. Let's see. How about one in history, what is demographic transition? A, the transition from high birth and death rates to low birth and death rates, or B, the transition from low birth and death rates to high birth and death rates, C, the transition of population from one area to another, D, a change in the percentage of minorities in a population, or E, a change in the workforce of a population?
Boy, you got me again. Our engineer Jim says A. Is that it?
He is correct.
Oh, hey.
That's correct.
Okay, he's doing the victory dance here. That's fantastic. Okay.
So that's just a sampling.
My goodness. What effect does participation in the decathlon, what effect does it have on kids' schoolwork and the building of their own self-discipline?
I think it has a very large effect on their self-discipline as well as just their confidence level, because they have been working with a group collaboratively, and they're in a position where people are relying on their information and their knowledge. So that boosts one's ego and their confidence level, as well as the fact that they are working together. This is a collaborative effort that does yield a very positive level of confidence in those that are partaking of it.
Well, Lori Stanley, thank you so much for being with us on the show today and making us all much more appreciative, believe me, of the dedication it takes to both coach and participate on an academic decathlon team. And congratulations again to the Blessed Sacrament team.
Oh, you're so welcome.
And please stay with us. When we come back, we'll talk about one of the more unusual high school sports, at least in Southern California, with the man who coaches it at Santa Margarita Catholic High School.
What do you love about Orange County? We hope it's our Catholic schools. That's why the Orange Catholic Foundation is participating in the Orange County Community Foundation's iHeartOC program, a special 30 hours to give where your heart lives campaign. This is Orange County's first ever Giving Day and will run from 6 a.m. on April 21st through noon on April 22nd. The Orange Catholic Foundation plans to use all the money raised during these 30 hours to help with tuition assistance in our local Catholic schools. Let's come together to show everyone how much we care for our children. Visit the website orangecatholicfoundation.org/iHeartOC for more information. Then share our link to your social network and encourage others to participate on Giving Day. All donations are eligible to receive bonus funds from the Community Foundation, which will help our Catholic schools and their students even more. Once again, the website is orangecatholicfoundation.org/iHeartOC. Please visit on the web and show your love for our Catholic schools.
Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio, AM 1000, and welcome to our next guest, Craig Johnson. Craig is the head hockey coach at Santa Margarita Catholic High School. Craig, many thanks for joining us today, and welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hockey is not a common high school sport in Southern California. Tell us how it got started at Santa Margarita and how you came to be the head coach.
Our hockey director is actually Mitch O'Brien, and Mitch had a younger son who was a Bantam at the time playing for the Junior Ducks.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of thrown around. They were talking about high school hockey, and Mitch thought it would be a great thing to do. And he started the program about 6 years ago, and it started with his son and about 12 others that were students at the school. And then we brought in, I believe, five or six other kids from outside the school. And that was our first year. We started with 12 students.
And you were all playing under the banner of Santa Margarita Catholic High School.
Yes, under the banner. And then the following year, we went to, I think, about 16 or 17 students of SM. And here we are in the sixth year. We had, I think, 44 kids that were in our program last year.
That's fantastic.
So, it's really taken off. The league in general has started with two teams, and now it's at, I believe, 44.
My goodness. And now it's a club sport at this point right now. Is that correct?
There are some teams that have kids from outside their school, or some are district schools.
Mm-hmm.
But Santa Margarita, J. Sarah, Servite, Orange Lutheran, Edison, they're all here. Bellarmine Prep from San Jose,
mm-hmm.
all of them are... All the kids are students of their schools.
Fantastic. Well, are your team members already experienced at the game by the time they come out for the team, or are some starting at a somewhat lower level?
Most of them, especially on the varsity, are all experienced players. You know, they've come from club hockey, and, you know, they want the experience of playing high school hockey and doing some and representing their schools. So all of them come in as pretty good players.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really neat thing to have. You know, my son is now at Santa Margarita, and for him to be able to go have lunch with his classmates, go to dances, you know, just go hang out after a workout, it's been a great experience for him. And the school, Santa Margarita, has been outstanding, too, as far as their support for the hockey program and, you know, what they do for the kids academically and athletically. First-class school.
Well, do most of the kids get their start at a fairly young age? They see hockey on TV, maybe, either the Kings or the Ducks, and they say, gosh, I think that would be great to do. And they go out to the local hockey rink and take lessons. Is that the idea?
Yeah, Yeah, more and more kids are starting. We have at the Junior Ducks, there's over 1,000 kids in the Learn to Play program right now.
Wow.
And, you know, you can see the big numbers, and it really has helped with the Ducks Stanley Cup win in 2007. And then the last 2 out of 3 years, the Kings have won. It's really brought interest to the sport. People are, you know, California, I believe in like 1996, I think there were, I want to say 4,000, 5,000 registered players in all of the state. Now there's over 22,000.
My goodness. Can you ascribe that just to the popularity of hockey out here in California, the fact that both the Kings and the Ducks have been winning? Both of them have won the Stanley Cup. And there are more rinks around. There's better coaching, more equipment available. All those things come together, I imagine.
Yeah, you're right on. It started with Wayne Gretzky coming, you know, to the Kings, and it's built from there. You know, obviously bringing the Anaheim Ducks into the NHL has helped grow the game, especially in Orange County. And as you said, the Stanley Cup wins have helped a lot because people love the playoffs. They love the atmosphere, and it makes kids want to play. And then yeah, it's a lot of former players that are now living in Orange County. They're coaching, whether it be their kids or just coming to give back. That's been, you know, very important in the development of the sport too. And then you have just people that they just love the game and they want to be around it. And all these things have helped build the sport.
Where does your team practice most of the time? Is there one particular venue that you go to?
Yeah, we're at Lake Forest, which is it's a one-sheet facility. It's not too far from the school either. There's lots of rinks around. That's the one we practice out of every time. We play most of our games out of Anaheim Ice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where most of the high schools play all their games.
Great. Well, what elements of the game and the sport of hockey in general tend to be strongest, and which tend to be a little less than strong among high school hockey players? Are they generally excellent skaters by the time they get to that level, and you don't have to concentrate on that? You can concentrate more on strategy and elements of the game?
Yeah, I'm a big believer that you have to continually grow a player's individual skills to help the team. So whether they're okay skaters or good skaters, it's something they're young enough where they got to continually improve on it. Puck handling, same way. You know, all the basics of the game you have to master. And, you know, adding that and adding gameplay, you know, whether it be small area games, because a lot of hockey is games, you know, basically it's a game that happens in small areas. You got to win puck battles. You got to move puck. You got to create situations where, you know, you can outnumber opponents, and it's, you know, game playing helps a lot. And then adding systems into practices or into your team structure is very important too at this age.
Well, we've touched on this just a little bit in earlier questions, but this question is kind of aimed particularly at parents whose younger kids may want to get into hockey, and they may see this as an ongoing thing and something for them to work on and play at the high school level or even the college level. So what does it take to bring a kid from being a rank beginner who's just lacing up his skates for the very first time to being a competent player in terms of time and talent? Can you pretty much teach any kid to be good, or is a lot of it inborn?
With hockey, it's such a hard sport to play, you know, because you are on little thin blades.
Right.
But to try to... It's repetition. You know, you get a kid on the ice when he's younger, you teach him, you know, the fundamentals of the game, and the kid becomes better, and he becomes better little by little. And, you know, you'll see kids that are, you know, fast developers, ones that all of a sudden they take off with it. Then you see other kids that are slow developers, and they might take a little longer. It's an investment for the parents, for sure, to bring a player from might up into the higher levels. But, you know, it takes a lot of Saturdays where you have to get up early with them. It takes a financial investment, investing in the equipment and the ice time, things like that. And, you know, you give the parents a lot of credit for, you know, for the sacrifices they make for their kids. But, you know, with anything, it's the inner drive of the kid that's going to make the player. If the kid loves the game, he's willing to put in the work, the practice, things like that, the kid will become better. you know, and they'll continue to grow. And, you know, it's fun to watch kids. You know, I've gone through it with two of my boys, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. And I coach my youngest one. He's 13 years old now, from the time he was 6 years old all the way through. And it's been time that I'll never forget, you know, whether it be road trips, whether it be the games, the practices. It's special bonding time with your kid. And I think when you look at it that way, you know, one day my kids are going to be gone. They're not going to be playing hockey anymore, and I'm going to miss the days when they were. So it is a special time, and you see why parents are involved in it and do it, and the investment that they make into it.
Absolutely. For your own players, what does it take in terms of time and commitment to participate? Is it something where if you're going to play hockey, you have really got to dig into it? It's not something that you can, you know, just blow off one or two days a week.
The season starts in August. We start with practices, start games in September, early September, and then we finish this year, and I believe it was March 22nd or 23rd.
Long season.
It is a long season. So what the kids have to put in as far as their commitment is, obviously, academics come first, and the kids have a, you know, Santa Margarita is a very sound academic school, and it takes a lot of work for them, whether it be homework, whether it be tutors or so on. And then we do weightlifting Monday and Wednesday, and we do on-ice training Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday. And then usually we have games Saturday and Sunday also. So it's you know, it's a full-time thing. And the kids and Santa Margarita have been great in understanding that these kids are putting in a lot of work, and they're allowing them to letter in the sport also. So the support from the school and, you know, what the kids put in, they're getting a lot out of it. And especially this year, it was a very rewarding year for the kids. They, you know, we didn't start off real strong. We had a real slow start to our season, and gradually we built up. They bought into the weightlifting, the system, the training. And by the end of the year, we ended up in the national championship game, and we lost to a team from Colorado, Regis Jesuit, by one goal, or actually it was two goals. They got an empty netter at the end.
Well, Craig Johnson, many thanks for taking time to be with us today. We will be rooting for the success of the team and its growing popularity in the coming months and years. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's it for another edition of Orange County Catholic Radio. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. for another hour of good talk and intriguing topics. You're tuned to Immaculate Heart Radio, AM 1000. I'm Patrick Mott.